You are listening to Oscar Conversion Therapy Survivor. The Oscar series is aimed at busting myths around queer topics and bringing you the realities faced by people who have actually experienced them. My name is Sheena. My pronouns are she, her. And I am joined today by two amazing guests who are doing a no-holds-barred discussion about conversion therapy and their experiences. Today I'm joined by Elena Joy. Thank you for joining me, Elena.
Thank you so much for having me. I am a speaker and a founder of a nonprofit and a mom of four beautiful kids and, yeah, and a lesbian. And my pronouns are she, her, and I am a conversion therapy survivor, so hence I am enjoying being on your program.
And I'm joined by Ray D. Magden. Ray, thank you for joining me today.
Hello, I'm Ray D. Magden. My pronouns are she, her. I'm an author of 10 books with the label Desert Palm Press. My latest release is Lucky Seven, which is a cyberpunk novel about a whole crew of queer characters taking down evil corporations with virtual heists. And it won a Golden Crown Literary Award and a Rainbow Award. So I'm really happy to be here today.
Fantastic. Today we're talking about why women survivors are silenced. It's an interesting thing because I would have thought that, I don't know why, apparently I'm just naive, but I would have thought that in this sort of context we would all want to band together regardless of gender to speak out, but apparently not. Apparently there's misogyny in this as well. Elena.
Yeah, I've had that experience, which I find, I agree that your first instinct is to think that we're all gonna, as survivors, there's so few of us, that we're gonna band together and work together to make this not happen. And in some regards, I have found that, including from men. There's the guy who really led the charge in Kentucky, getting the Kentucky conversion therapy ban. His name is Zach Myers, and he owns a film production company in Louisville. And when I saw the publicity and all the quotes were his, I reached out to him and was like, this is so awesome, congratulations. And we kind of went back and forth. And it turns out because he has a film company, his like pet project on the side is doing a documentary about conversion therapy survivors. And he said, I have six men and no women. And so I'd really like to have you involved. And I thought that was what very started the first, like, okay, so are there a lot fewer female survivors, or are you just not looking for them, or are they not making themselves available to you? Like, what is that cause, right? And then the more I looked into conversion therapy survivors, the more I realized, yeah, the ones that are in the media are almost all men. So I'm sure there's a lot of different reasons. I think that it's possible that parents are a lot more likely to send their male children to conversion therapy than their female children. It seems like lesbianism is more accepted than male homosexuality.
Well, I have theories about why parents would be more likely to send a cisgender boy as far as they know. And it's because gender nonconformity is not, people aren't thrilled about it with women either, don't get me wrong. All you have to do is read Stone Butch Blues to understand that. But gender nonconformity is slightly less taboo when practiced by cisgender women than when practiced by cisgender men. So, because of the misogyny in our culture, there is nothing worse than to be a woman, and to be a gay male is to make yourself the equivalent of a woman, which is bad, which the parents don't want for their son, so they send him to make him less effeminate. But that being said, I know lots of female queer people who have been through this, and I do think a lot of it isn't that we don't get sent, it's that we often find ourselves without a platform to talk about our experiences because there is misogyny in the gay community, in the wider queer community. Often cisgender gay men will deliberately exclude people with experiences that are different than their own. And that includes lesbians, that includes bisexual people of both genders, of any genders, gender non-conforming, non-binary people, all get excluded as well. So, you know, it echoes the power dynamics that we see in our wider world. There's also, unfortunately, racism in the queer community that is more prevalent than you would expect in a marginalized community. And that's very sad to me, but it does not surprise me that more straight parents are sending their sons because they're worried about gender nonconformity, and B, that the women who do get sent often are silenced after the fact by the misogyny in the wider queer community.
And that's when I realized, when it happened to me, of course, because so often we don't realize something exists until it affects us directly. But it was here in Arizona when the conversion therapy, I mean, we've tried to ban it multiple times, but this last cycle, right before quarantine, everything went to hell. We got two more state legislators that said that they would agree to it, like off the books, off the record. They were like, yeah, we're in. And so then the odds became a lot more in our favor. And so people were ready to rally again and ready to make this, to propose a bill and go down that whole path. And so the guy who's been the most vocal about it in town sent out an all call, like, any conversion therapy survivors, it's time to rally up. And when the responses came back to him, the only people he invited were all men. And I know from three different people that he knows that I'm here, that I'm talking, that I'm in the media, that this is my entire job, and I live 45 minutes from the state capitol. And so then to realize, oh, this is deliberate. It's not because they just don't know that I'm here. Like, I have confirmation from three different people. They know I'm here, and I'm not invited, and I'm not allowed in. My experience is not as valid. And that's odd.
That's one reason I wanted to do this podcast, because it took me so long to admit to myself that what I had been through was conversion therapy, because the only experiences I had had with it were television shows like Criminal Minds or whatever detective show, SVU, where it's usually teenage white boys who are sent away to a camp and given some kind of horrible physical abusive treatment to make them straight. And so any experience that differs from that feels like it gets invalidated in a lot of these platforms, and it's insidious. I'm sure some of it is deliberate and some of it is not. I think some of it is just, you know, the popular conceptions we have of things are not always how they are in reality. But the reason I decided to say yes to this was because I am hoping that people listen to this and a couple other people recognize themselves in this experience and realize that, yeah, you can call what happened to you conversion therapy, even if you weren't hooked up to some kind of weird machine, and it still damaged you and it's still trauma that you deserve help recovering from.
Absolutely. Isn't it so interesting how we first have to validate our experiences to ourselves before we can figure out how to get help for them, right? Like, that's very common in the trauma experiences as well, right? Like, okay, yeah, I was assaulted or this happened to me, but it's not as bad as my friend who had this experience. So why can I even pity myself or ask for help or give myself grace? Because her experience was so much worse.
I will say that the women and non-binary survivors of A, conversion therapy, and B, some kind of sexual assault, generally don't make a who has it worst list. I have some friends and acquaintances that have been through horribly traumatic experiences, and not a single one of them has invalidated my experience to make themselves seem better, I guess. I don't know what people hope to accomplish with that.
I think Elena's point is sort of the flip of that, is you will invalidate your own experiences based on the fact that you know some other woman who's had it worse. So her experience is valid. Mine can't be valid because mine was less bad.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. People often have this idea in their head that other people are going to judge them for getting off quote unquote easier or for having a less traumatic experience. By whose metric? Who's measuring this stuff? Who gets to decide what's more traumatic? But also the people who have been through that really serious trauma that you're comparing yourself with often aren't doing that comparing themselves. A lot of it is internal and not accurate to what the other person you're comparing yourself with is really thinking.
I would totally agree with that. Absolutely. One of the biggest messages that I've put out that have resonated with a cross population of people is I've said, trauma isn't just the bad things that happen to you. Trauma can also be the lack of good things that happen to you. And for people to hear that and realize, you're right. Like, I mean, I'm in a relationship with a woman who says, I was never beaten. I was never treated horribly. Like, I had a pretty good childhood. So she felt bad about the fact that she has issues stemming from childhood. And for me to be able to say, yeah, they never beat you, but they also never really expressed love. You also never really had any, like, a one-on-one date with mom to go get ice cream, right? Like, there was a lack of good experiences, and that can be just as traumatizing as a plethora of bad experiences.
As women, particularly, we are trained to invalidate our pain in favor of the comfort of others.
Yeah, what is that about? I do not get that.
I don't get it either, but it sure is a mood. I think a lot of my queer trauma comes from the fact, not that my parents did horrible things to me, but that they didn't support an important part of me. And that's a valid kind of trauma too.
Yeah.
But Ray, I'm not trying to disagree with you, except that I'm about to disagree with you. The fact that your folks said to you that there was something enough wrong with you that you had to be fixed is a trauma.
And you hear it right now, me diminishing what I went through. You see a live example before you of a woman diminishing her own trauma for the comfort of others.
Right.
Yeah. You're right.
Even survivors who've come out of this, who are more aware of their own space and their own feelings and have gone through the therapy and are doing the work, even survivors still have that doubt.
It is such an easy trap to fall into.
It is. Myself included. I've had more than one conversation with my therapist who's saying, why is this the first time you've brought this up? Like, you've been talking to me for months and months and months now. Why is this traumatic experience the first time that you've told me this? And I said, well, I didn't think it was that important. And her response is always like, oh my gosh. Yes, your experience is important. Your trauma is important. It's very important. It's the reason you're sitting on the couch.
It's one of those things where you're talking to a friend and either you or they bring up a childhood memory that they think is funny. And then the other person says, wow, that's actually really messed up.
Yes.
Yeah. Then you're like, oh, wait. Yeah, it is messed up that my mom knew I was autistic and didn't take me to get diagnosed. I thought it was funny. I thought it was a funny story about how when I told her I was autistic, she said, I know. But now that you mention it, so.
Yes, I have this very distinct memory of standing in line at a bakery with a friend, and she was kind of complaining about her husband, right? Like, this was like mom's night out kind of thing. And I responded with something like, well, all wives hate sex. And I laughed because I thought it was a joke. And she stopped and looked at me and was like, no, Elena, actually some of us really like it. And that was like the first time that I kind of questioned, like, no, like all wives have to hate sex. This needs to be normal. I thought I was normal. I'm normal. It was a big eye-opener that night.
That fundamental premise that women are meant to hate sex is such a prevalent thing in the heterosexual community, though. It really is.
Huh. I don't think I'd ever realized that before.
Yes, it's actually quite horrifying.
I don't get it. Are you guys okay? If there are any straight people listening to this, are the straights okay? Do you need help?
No, they're not okay. I can attest to that.
Thank you for being an awesome listener and supporting Tilt, the channel that brings you all the podcasts you want to hear. You're listening to Tilt. Find more podcasts on thelesbiantalkshow.com. Have you experienced this in other areas, either of you?
Well, I mean, this is sort of related to conversion therapy. I have noticed just in general in the queer community, fictional stories by women are often less widely shared, less likely to receive awards and attention, and less likely to be mentioned by other people. So if that holds true for fictional stories, as I know it does, because stories featuring male queer characters are way more accessible and widely shared than stories featuring queer female characters, it is no surprise to me that people's real life stories follow a similar bent, where men's stories are prioritized and women's stories are assumed to be only for other women, as opposed to universally accessible and universally relatable. It's like men can't relate to women or think they shouldn't be able to relate to women, but women are expected to relate to men and everybody.
I would agree. I mean, in the context of art imitates life, the movie Boy Erased was first a book that did very, very, very well. And so then, of course, it got movie rights, and then it was made into a movie and it did very, very well. And it's considered like kind of the gold standard of like, this is how society and Hollywood is valuing this story. I'm just barely getting a foothold into being able to be published. So I'm like a solid 5 to 10 years away from being able to do a movie, right? Like, it's just the discrepancy in time frame. And yet, at least that path was blazed, I guess. Like, I can try to tell myself that. On the other hand, you have someone like Glennon Doyle, who had that bestseller book, has this amazing community, and now Oprah is doing her movie. Like, Glennon Doyle, who has sold millions of books, could not get her movie rights until Oprah stepped in and said, yeah, let's do it. Yeah, it's the value is going to have to come from other powerful women, because I don't think that a male system will give that value to our stories.
And there lies the whole thing of vote with your money. As women, use your money to support women or queer folks, you know, the minorities, the people who are not getting supported.
I feel that that's incredibly important. And I mean, I built my career on that. I have a Patreon specifically so people who want to see more queer-focused media involving women and women-identified and women-adjacent people can find a place to support that content. You know, it helps me, but it also feels really good to contribute to the authors and the screenwriters and the artists who are making the content you care about. I hope that people will take that love that they have for supporting their favorite media and carry it over into real life, where you are offering support to the people like Elena who are putting themselves out there to testify to their personal experiences. It's a really similar thing, and just word of mouth can mean a whole lot in situations like that. I mean, I'm very much looking forward when you launch your nonprofit in June to sharing that as widely as I can. And I hope that people listening to the podcast, I hope there'll be a link so that they can share what you're starting to work on, because I think it's pretty exciting.
I can't wait to read your books. I've never read any books. Literally, I've never read any books that have queer characters ever in my whole life.
Really?
For real.
How? You're on the podcast that's adjacent to the Lesbian Review, which is literally a review site for lesbian books.
Oh, really?
Yep. That's like literally what I do with my life.
Yes. They're not the same thing, as Sheena has told me many times, but the Lesbian Review is run by the same people who do the Lesbian Talk Show. And the Lesbian Review, you should go there. You should go to that website because it has every category you can possibly imagine of books featuring queer women. There's fantasy, science fiction, there's romance tropes, all kinds of romance tropes. There's historical fiction, there's mysteries, it's everything. There's a whole world out there for you. I will send you an autographed copy of one of my books if you want, but you should go to the Lesbian Review and read these stories. That's how I was able to like come out of this pit that conversion therapy put me in, is by reading these books and seeing, wow, queer women can actually be happy. And it makes me so sad and so mad that they aren't more widely circulated. I mean, here you are, a lesbian who's been out for several years, and you didn't even know the whole lesbian publishing world existed. And it's like, this thing saved me. How can we get our experiences and our work out there for more people who could really use it but don't even know it's there? And I don't know the answer to that question because I've been trying for years.
So have I. I've been working my butt off to keep building the audience and allowing people to find me.
We are so grateful to you for it. I think you've been successful in many ways, but there's still so many more people who have no idea that this world exists.
And the thing is, lesbian fiction helped me come out. So that's my goal, is to help others figure it out.
I find it really interesting. So my audience that has stuck with me has seen the whole transition, right? So I literally evolved my Instagram audience from my portrait photography into now my LGBTQ speaking life. And so I've lost a lot, but the ones that have stayed have been really interesting. And lately I've been binging on that Netflix show Feel Good, which has a lesbian storyline, right? And so I've been posting that. And a lot of my audience has responded with, well, Lena, why would I watch that? Because I'm not queer. And I've responded, and this has gone like wildfire, I've responded with, I spent my entire life retranslating heterosexual art into what I could relate to. You can try it for a day. You can try it for an episode.
Reading something in your native language instead of having to take that extra step. And that's why I like reading lesbian fiction. It's obviously not the only thing I read. I love children's literature that doesn't have queer characters, although it's better with queer characters. But lesbian literature is just so great. And it is like there's this just automatic connection and understanding you don't have to put any work toward. That you have to put that work into connecting with, for example, a heterosexual romance. Some things are lost in translation.
Sorry, to go back to the misogyny and the silence in this world, I don't think I realized how much I felt it until I was in a situation where I didn't feel it, right? It's one of those situations where you're the frog in the warm pot of water, right? So when I jumped out of that pot, I was being interviewed by a gay man on his podcast called The Out Entrepreneur, and his name is Rhodes Perry. And I went into it with some trepidation, thinking every time I have done an interview with a gay man, we have not gelled. It has not gone well. There's some ego there. There's a barrier there. So I went into this with some trepidation, but I'd heard good things about him. And there we are on a Zoom call doing an interview. And he was so kind and so respectful and so just genuine. And that's when I realized, oh, yeah, those other interviews were not great. Like, I thought they were okay, but they were really not okay. This is what I want. This experience is what I want. So I agree. So oftentimes we can feel misogyny without recognizing it. And we oftentimes we can't recognize it until we've gotten out of that pot of boiling water and realize, oh, this is how I want to be treated. This is how I want to interact.
Absolutely, especially if you're in an environment where it's normalized for men to be taking the lead, for men to know what's good for you to take a passive role. All right, do either of you want to add anything else to this one?
I have something to add. It's really important that if you can, if you feel safe doing so and have a platform with which to do so, to share your experiences. Your experiences of homophobia, your experiences of misogyny, your experiences of spiritual abuse in your faith community if you grew up in that kind of environment. Because even if you don't necessarily get a whole bunch of messages from people, I guarantee you that people are reading what you're saying or listening to what you're saying if it's in an audio format. People are taking in your story, even if they don't directly engage with it in the form of comments. There's lots of people out there going through the same things you are who might just be lurking because they don't feel empowered enough to interact with the story yet. But that doesn't mean that it isn't being read. And this holds true in fiction. If you, you know, are writing a little fan fiction and you don't get a lot of comments, that doesn't mean the people aren't reading it and enjoying it, and they're just maybe feeling shy about commenting, or maybe don't have the ability to comment because they're in a closeted environment. But I mean, the same really holds true for sharing your personal experiences. So I would encourage you, if you can, if you're in a safe position emotionally and physically to do so, to share your story and know that people you might not even have imagined are taking it in and learning from it and engaging with it within themselves, even if they're not engaging with it via the comment section. So I think you would be surprised how resonant that stuff can be.
I agree. And I think only to build on that is the concept of recognize your own privilege and use it. It can be so helpful to you in resolving your own issues, but you can make such a difference. So for example, I have the privilege of being a lesbian mom. I have raised am raising four children. I know the ins and outs of parenthood. I get it. And so I can talk to moms of LGBT kids in a way that other lesbians who don't have kids can't. That just is what it is. It's not down or it's not above. It just is what it is. And so I have an obligation. I have a duty to reach out to those moms of LGBT kids and say, I get it. I know your heart and I know you love them. And I know you're just trying to do what's good by them. And we can communicate in a way. Whereas I can't reach out to, like, I don't have the experience of doing in vitro, right? So I can't talk that talk to them. I can't resonate with them, with people who are struggling with that at all, right? So I feel like a huge part of our responsibility. So if you extend that to like a gay man who in his interaction with a lesbian like me, and he treats me well and he treats me with respect, like that is big. It changes my perception of that entire population. It helps heal wounds that I have, right? Like, it teaches me that I can communicate with this population and I can do it well when there are people who can be kind to me, right? And so I just feel like there is a way to help heal that misogyny. There is a way to help heal our community. It's recognizing what we have and bring it to the table and help. Using it to help others. Sorry, that was a really long way of saying that.
No, I think that's a very valid point. Absolutely.
I'm just super grateful to the men, the gay and bi, and even the straight men who go out of their way to support the female members of the queer community and non-binary people who might not be in a position to have their stories spread as widely without their input. It's super helpful when people in places of privilege within a marginalized community look for people who are even less privileged and amplify their voices. They don't even just repeat what that person said, but they direct their audience to the source. And that's how I would recommend going about it. I mean, I'm not sure how many gay men are listening to the lesbian talk show, but I mean, this holds true for other things, like for white privilege. I mean, I recognize that I have a lot of privileges because I'm white and cisgender. So when I can, I try to pass the mic to trans women and women of color when something to do with their experiences needs their input.
Elena, where can people find you online if they want to connect with you?
Oh, great. So it's funny because I'm kind of in a transition point. If you want to really connect, I am most open on Instagram under Elena Joy Experience. If you want to connect to me about public speaking, which no one's doing public speaking right now, thank you, Corona, my website right now is elenajoyexperience.com. But I am just this week launching the Pride and Joy Foundation. So you can go to prideandjoyfoundation.com. There's a preview page and a way for you to get in on the ground floor, being a founding member. And then that'll have a soft launch in May and then a hard launch in June for Pride Month. So I'm super excited about supporting those families.
Fantastic. Thank you. Ray, where can people find you online?
Well, I'm easy because my name is Rady Magden everywhere. Facebook, my page is Rady Magden, RAEDMAGDON. Same on Twitter, @RadyMagden. Tumblr, Rady Magden. Website, http://radymagden.com. So, yeah, but I'm everywhere.
You have been listening to Ask a Conversion Therapy Survivor. The Asker series is aimed at busting myths around queer topics and bringing you the realities faced by people who have actually experienced them. My name is Sheena, my pronouns are she, her, and I was joined today by two amazing guests, Elena and Ray. You can find their contact details in the show notes, should you wish to reach out to them. That's all for this episode.